All right. Well, we've come to one of the more interesting of our five famous leaders, Douglas MacArthur, General Douglas MacArthur. And he spans a lot of what we have done. There he is. Talking about some of the wars that we've talked about. I mean, World War I, World War II, Korean War, and we'll focus on the Korean War in terms of the war itself, but we're going to spend a lot of time, or some of the time, also talking, leading up to that point as well, talking about the things that he has done and getting a little picture of his character, because he is a character. As some have said, they've described him as a man of opposites. He's a very polarizing figure in a lot of ways. I watched some interviews of some of the people that have worked with him, who have served under him, and it has they have a lot of good things to say and a lot of bad things to say. So there are quite a few opinions. And everybody's got one on MacArthur. So, but as we look at it, I want to focus on some of the foundations that, in terms of his faith, as I put that in quotes. We'll make a decision on that at the end, as Pastor Pete has, where we can talk about that. And as we look through his life and just some of the things he's done, some of the things he's said, I spent a lot of time going through his book, Reminiscences. So that's just him at the end of his life thinking through the things that he had done. He spent a lot of time talking about how he grew up, the things he did in the wars, and the other things that he spent time doing. So we'll look at that. But it's a great great thing to read if you want to spend some time just hearing MacArthur in his own words. You have to take that with a grain of salt, because everybody looks back on their own past as a with rose-colored glasses sometimes. But I wanted to hear some things that he had to say in his own words, especially about his upbringing and as it related to his faith. So that was good. There's some other really good books out there on MacArthur, and I'll let you look through that. There are a lot of them, but there's some very, very good ones. One of the big ones is by a gentleman by the name of William Manchester. The book is called American Caesar. You can kind of see where that is right now. But he had this to say about MacArthur that I thought was good to see. But he says he was a thundering paradox of a man, noble and ignoble, inspiring and outrageous, arrogant and shy, the best of men and the worst of men, the most protean, most ridiculous, and most sublime. I'll let you get that in your slides. But that first sentence really encompasses what you start to read and see and hear and look at as you're talking about MacArthur, and it's a very interesting thing. But first, let's. One of the places that we've been talking about all the wars and looking at key figures in those wars, and MacArthur certainly at the beginning of the Korean War is a key figure. So why don't we go on to our outline, and we will look at some of the causes of the Korean War. We'll do five of them. The first one was the end of World War II. Believe it or not, that was a cause. The end of World War II meant the restoration of peace and prosperity for most of the world. And so for Korea, it meant a freedom they hadn't experienced since Japan had annexed them in 1903. The Japanese were very brutal in their treatment of the Koreans, as well as any other nation that they conquered, including during World War II and the treatment of soldiers. And Korea was no different. So they had been under their subjugation for 50 years, essentially. And so many Koreans after World War II were anticipating a united Korean peninsula. But the entry of the USSR into the war against Japan in the waning months of World War II basically made that impossible. We had, there's the end of World War II there, that famous picture. You can also see that statue in San Diego on the Embarcadero. But just a few of the newspaper articles out there that you see at the end of World War II, both in Europe and then again in Japan, And the relief that was felt at that time, just to have that done. I mean, it was a major thing. All right. The Soviets agreed to join the war against Japan after the Yalta Conference in February of 1945. That's where this was taken. So you've got Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin. Roosevelt would pass away just a few months after this. He died in the early April, I believe. And this was taken in February at the Yalta Conference. So when the USSR got involved, they began to drive the Japanese out of the northern part of Korea and push them, and they started to set up roads and lines of communication basically down to that 38th parallel that we are so familiar with in terms of Korea. All right. Number two, the U.S. drawdown. With troops heading home after the surrender of Japan in August of 1945, the U.S. presence in Korea went from a garrison of 40,000 soldiers to a small advisory team of 472 officers and men. The Korean army in the south was armed with light weapons, while the Soviet-backed Korean army in the north was heavily equipped with tanks and other armored vehicles. So the U.S. was trying to let Korea be Korea. The U.N. was involved in what to do with all of these nations that had needed help. But the Russians, the Soviets, were pushing and spending a lot of time and putting a lot of effort into the northern portion of Korea there. Thirdly, we have the rise of communism and Cold War. Obviously, communism had been rising since World War I, but really get this into hyperdrive after World War II, and obviously the beginning of the Cold War. But it was clear by the end of World War II that the philosophical differences between the U.S. and the USSR were breaking down after their short-lived alliance to complete the war. The Soviets wanted to expand the sphere of communism in Korea, while the U.S. wanted to promote democracy, and the U.S. stressed the importance of containment to halt the spread of communism. And that became our politics. It became containment and appeasement in a lot of ways. So containment was, we were giving, thought I had another picture there, but apparently not. We were giving a help to nations in terms of financial aid that were trying to fight communism as a way to fight communism. and the Russians were providing military and pushing their way in that way. We weren't doing it with military force at all. So, fourthly, we've got the division of Korea. And this was done at the Potsdam Conference in the summer of 1945. It was decided that Korea would be divided at the 38th parallel into a communist North Korea and a democratic South Korea, with the hope that the two united in the future would be united in the future. And that was the plan. That was what they were trying to do. In 1947, the UN pushed for a united Korea with elections to be held in 1948. the USSR opposed these elections, and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea was established in the north, and with Kim Il-sung as the prime minister, and then the U.S.-backed Syngman Rhee was elected as president of the Republic of Korea in the south. Both countries claim sovereignty over the whole Korean peninsula. So you can see we have a problem right there. So there's a map of that, 38th parallel, and the Korean U.S.-backed South Korea and the Russian-backed North Korea. There's a little side note, Syngman Rhee. So he won the election. The Russians boycotted the election process and just appointed their guy in there. Both, you see those two highlighted at the bottom there, both were highly authoritarian and violent and wanted to unify Korea. So a lot of skirmishing on the 38th parallel leading up to the Korean War, but you can see the beginnings of this already in how these things were handled here. Lastly, we've got indecisive U.S. support. indecisive is not the best word, but I couldn't think of anything better, so I put that on there. But I'll explain that in a little bit. So while articulating the guidelines of the U.S. foreign policy of containment, Secretary of State Acheson indicated that it was a policy primarily non-military, with economic and military aid given to non-communist regimes in Asia. The promise, and this is why it was indecisive, is that military force would only be given to defend Japan, the Ricus Islands, and the Philippine Islands. South Korea was left off the list in that. I believe this is where I have this other slide. Yeah, there you go. The application of containment policy, just a little bit of that, just a couple of images of how that looked in terms of the U.S. and the Russians. But by leaving South Korea off of the list that they would, you know, attack, you know, that they would fight militarily to defend, gave the Chinese and the Russians the thoughts they needed to attack eventually into North Korea, which was going to begin the war. So they didn't believe the U.S. would get involved. And so they felt like they had carte blanche to go in and take over the whole peninsula. And we'll see that at the end here. But before we get there, we want to talk a little bit about Douglas MacArthur and a little bit about Episcopalianism, which is what he was from. So that's going to be our next chore here, is take a look at a brief history of the Episcopal Church. But back on your outline there, we'll talk a little bit about that. So the Episcopalian Church has its roots in the Anglican Church, which was established itself at the founding of Jamestown back in 1607. So while the New World continued to grow in size and population, the Church of England was also establishing churches. And by the time of the American Revolution, Anglicans, Presbyterians, and Congregationalists made up the three main religions in America. Obviously, the Church of England was not popular during the American Revolution, and Anglicans lost their connection with England, and so they had to reorganize. And so they reorganized essentially into the Protestant Episcopal Church. And that's where we have the foundings of the Episcopal Church. They have a line of apostolic succession in the Episcopal Church, but they couldn't go back to the Anglican Church in England to get their ordination, so they went to the Scottish Church and got their ordination from there, trying again because England wasn't that popular, obviously, after the war. So currently, bringing us to the future, this is how the Episcopal Church describes itself: Protestant, yet Catholic. They have a lot of the forms and functions that you'll find in the Catholic Church in terms of how they their liturgy and how they go through a church service. The Book of Common Prayer is central, just as it is in Anglicanism, central to their worship. Currently, they ordain women and LGBT people to the priesthood. And as of 2016, the church had 1.7 million members. And that has steadily been declining since the year 2000. Coincidence? I think not. So just given some of those other things that we just read about. St. Luke's Church on the left there is one of the oldest surviving Anglican churches. It dates back to the middle of the 17th century. And then on the right, you've got St. John's Episcopal Church in Washington, D.C. It's dubbed the Church of the Presidents. In fact, every president has been, a sitting president has attended a service there, with the exception of Richard Milhouse Nixon, so for whatever that's worth. But St. John's Episcopal Church there in Washington, D.C. Just to give you an idea, but that's the church, the denomination that Douglas MacArthur grew up in, as we move to General Douglas MacArthur. Born in 1880, died in 1964. And so back on your outline there, let's jump to his early life. Early life of Douglas MacArthur. He was born January 26, 1880, in Little Rock, Arkansas. That's where he was born. His father, Arthur MacArthur, was in the military still at the time. It's not a joke. He was Arthur the MacArthur III. So it runs in the family. That's the a military base in Little Rock. We'll get to that. So back on the outline, he was a member of the Christ Episcopal Church, where he was christened. Thought I had a picture of that. There it is, Christ Episcopal Church. It's still there. He was christened. His father, Arthur MacArthur, was a lieutenant general in the Civil War who earned the Medal of Honor for his heroics in the Battle of Missionary Ridge in November of 1863. So there's Arthur wearing his medal, and there's just sort of a depiction of the Battle of Missionary Ridge. That's in Tennessee near Murfreesboro, something. I think that's how you pronounce it. And he won the Medal of Honor for that there. I wanted to jump back to this quote you saw there. Bible lessons began to open the spiritual portals of a growing faith. So after being homeschooled by his mother, you see that on there, his mother Mary Pinky MacArthur homeschooled her children and became very protective of her sons after the death of their middle son from measles when he was five. Malcolm was his name, and as you can imagine, that would be tragic, and Mom was very obviously protective of her other two sons that were still living. MacArthur was the youngest of the three, and she'll spend a lot of time with him, you'll see as we move forward. They sent him to West Texas Military Academy, where he graduated as valedictorian, and the Bible was one of his core classes. He played quarterback, shortstop, and tennis there, so he was quite an athlete. Obviously quite a student as well, being a valedictorian there. But this is a quote from one of his studies there at West Texas Military Academy. This is in San Antonio. It is run by the Episcopal Church and started just a few years prior to him being there. But that was one of his quotes from his book, Reminiscences. It says, Bible lessons began to open the spiritual portals of a growing faith. Very interested in the Bible, read it. There's some quotes about him reading the Bible every day of his life from a number of people. We see that, and even people making jokes about it that I'll show you in a little bit. But jump forward here. There's the church again there. So there's Arthur MacArthur, the dad, sitting with Douglas to his right there, and then that is not his daughter. That is actually Douglas MacArthur. Does look at that. There's the oldest brother there who died early in the 1900s, and then his mom, Pinky. So there's West Texas Military Academy, a little shot of Douglas there at his study desk, and we'll leave it there for now. So after West Texas Military Academy, he applied to West Point. He was rejected twice before getting entry into West Point. It's funny that Douglas does not mention that in his reminiscences. So funny how we, when we write our own histories, what we can leave out and put in. But he was rejected twice. He was finally entered in June of 1899. He played on the baseball team there. And he graduated first in his class in 1903. He had the third highest score ever recorded in the history of the school. So, again, a very brilliant man, and he showed it at West Point. There's a statue of him at West Point, and there's the school in the background on the right. And so this is one of the things, once he got in, he wrote about preparedness is the key to victory. After missing the first two times, it didn't say, but I can imagine that maybe having graduated valedictorian, being an athlete on a three-sport athlete, he might have had a little bit of hubris or pride going into that, thinking no problem. He comes from a military family who'd won the Medal of Honor. He had the I think at the first time, Grover Cleveland was his sponsor, President Grover Cleveland. The second time, he had a president as well, so he might have had a little bit of, you know, pride going into that by missing it. The third time around, he did, sounds like he prepared a little bit better for it and actually got in. So that was one of the comments he made on his getting in to West Point, and served him well throughout his career in the military as well. There's a picture of the West Point baseball team. He is right here, this guy right here. And that is a picture of his mom, Pinky. Pinky took an apartment near West Point when Arthur got in, or I'm sorry, Douglas got in, and spent a lot of time there with him. So he was, a lot of people called him a mama's boy. Mom was around a lot, and with a hovering, protective mom, she might have been the first helicopter parent. So, I don't know. We'll see. But she was around quite a bit in his life. She travels with him to the Philippines a little later when he takes a command there as well. So, all right. World War One. Before we jump onto that, I got another quote here from his teaching as a child. It says, "Our teaching included not only the simple rudiments, but above all else, a sense of obligation. We were to do what was right, no matter what the personal sacrifice might be. Our country was to come first, as you would expect in a military family. And two things we must never do: we must never lie, and we must never tattle." There was an incident while he was at West Point of hazing, and of course Douglas was hazed as a plebe at West Point, and he was brought before the leadership to testify, and he testified that there was hazing, but he did not testify to who did the hazing. So he was true to that as well. All right, let's jump back to our outline and talk about World War One. Leading up to World War One, the U.S. was concerned about invasion from Mexico and ordered the occupation of Veracruz in 1914. So Captain MacArthur at the time led an unauthorized team on a mission which earned him consideration for the Medal of Honor, but was denied. So you got a picture here. There's our captain, MacArthur there. Sporting the corncob pipe there on the right. So that started early on, as we see that iconic picture of him. So he, so I said this was an unauthorized excursion that he did. So what was the story was, he had, they had a lot of supplies in trains that they needed for their what would be an incursion into Veracruz, but they had no engines. And they heard that there were engines further down in Veracruz. So they was told not to go do this. Against orders, he went and took 5-man team. They took a hand cart on the railroad tracks all the way down, confirmed that there were 5 engines down there, and all the while fighting off bands of the Mexican army. And a couple of the men that were with him got shot. He made it back, was able to tell the senior leadership that there were engines down there, that they could get done what they could get done. His commanding officers put him up for the Medal of Honor, but the government decided that it probably is not a good idea to give the Medal of Honor to somebody who disobeyed orders. Even though it was a brave thing to do, and he was, and it was helpful in the war, so he was denied that in that particular time. Back on our outline, so war was declared on Germany in 1917, and Major MacArthur at the time, now he's been promoted, he lobbied for the formation of the 42nd, quote-unquote, Rainbow Division. That has nothing to do with LGBT and the Episcopal Church, who have hijacked our rainbow. But it was made up of National Guardsmen from a number of different states. That's why they called it the Rainbow Division, because it encompassed a lot of different states in this guard. So he and his commanding officer came up with this idea, and they put it into place. MacArthur was put in leadership in that. He wasn't the leader until the very end of the war, but the Rainbow Division was very instrumental. They were involved in numerous battles and offensive, which for MacArthur earned many honors, swiftly rising through the ranks from major to brigadier general by the end of the war. So he's rising up the ranks quickly. Smart, obviously brave, and intelligent in terms of military strategy. The Rainbow Division, there's just a little map of the places they had been all through France and Austria and Germany. So you get an idea of some of the places they had been throughout the war. I'll go through some of his awards that later on in the message here. But he earned a lot of things in there, including the. Here we go. This was just a comment from French General Henri Girard, one of the finest and bravest officers I had ever served with, and he was awarded the Distinguished Service Medal. That's General Pershing pinning that on Douglas MacArthur there on the right, and then there's a shot of Douglas MacArthur sitting in a French chateau. Nice riding crop. We should all don that look with the riding crop, but he posed for that picture there. But Distinguished Medal, Distinguished Service Medal, won Silver Crosses as well for bravery. A brave soldier was Douglas MacArthur, and was a brigadier general by the end of World War I. All right, World War II. I threw everything that happened between World War I and World War II into the first couple of sentences of this section. I'm going to breeze through 22 years of his life in two sentences, and we'll spend a little time on the slides here once we get through a couple of these things. But between the wars, from 1919 to 1941, MacArthur continued his military career as the youngest superintendent of West Point since 1817. He was promoted to major general, also the youngest to do that. He got married, served in the Philippines, was president of the American Olympic Committee, got divorced, became the youngest Army Chief of Staff at 50, got remarried, had a child, returned again to the Philippines as Field Marshal of the Philippine Army. Thank you very much. Have a good day. No, that was a lot of things that he did, but let's just take a look at a few of that, and we'll talk a little bit about those. There he is, superintendent of West Point for 4 years there. He was... he modified and revamped everything that was going on at West Point at the time, bringing them up to the day there, bringing up to modern standards, things that he'd learned in the war and how the men needed to be trained. He was instrumental in kind of just updating the academy to be able to do that. Here's a quote from some of the from Congress regarding his service time there. When he was done, the seven-member United States Congress reported enthusiastically. They said, "The board desires to emphasize its strong approval of the splendid service that General MacArthur and the officers associated with him are rendering to the country by constructing a new West Point founded on the lessons and experiences and the sacrifices of the World War and in the spirit of the old West Point." So he left there with glowing reviews in terms of what he was doing there at West Point. He got married in 1922 to Louise Cromwell Brooks. She had two children already from a previous marriage. She was a socialite, as they call them, had money, and she enjoyed her time. He was immediately sent to the Philippines after marrying Louise Cromwell, because General Pershing also took a shine to Miss Cromwell, and because General Pershing outranked General MacArthur, he decided that he would send him away, and so he sent him to the Philippines. So the whole family went to the Philippines at that time. That's what MacArthur says about Pershing and him sending him there. Pershing denied it, but who can say? Anyway, got married. She actually separated from him in 1927. The divorce was final in 1929. He did not seek the divorce. She did, and Bob's your uncle. That's what happened there. He was president of the U.S. Olympic team from 1927 to 1928. The previous president died suddenly, and so they were looking for someone to replace him, but who better than General Douglas MacArthur? And so there he is on the ship going over to Amsterdam. That's where the Olympics were held that year, the Summer Olympics. And there's just a few members. There is Douglas and his wife, Louise Cromwell, there. She was still with him in this particular time. And then this is one of the quotes he set out to gave to the crew there at the Olympics. We're here to represent the greatest country on earth. We did not come here to lose gracefully. We came here to win and win decisively. Spoken like a true general, right? We came here to win and win decisively. And when they did, they did it by points in that time. So 17 new records, and they won more victories than the next two countries combined. destroyed the Olympics that year under his leadership. So anyway, he became Army Chief of Staff in 1930. He was there for 5 years. He's being sworn in. Unfortunately, in the 30s, what are we going through in the 1930s? The Depression. So the government is reducing its military, and so Douglas was dealing with a lot of that during that time. At one point, Roosevelt wanted to get rid of, cut the army down to 50% of its size. And he was, Douglas was not having any of that. He was livid about that. He did manage to save a lot of the more officers' jobs, and there's a lot going on here. But one quick quote that went down as he was Army Chief, Roosevelt was trying to cut the army down by 51%, he goes, he storms into Roosevelt's office and lectures him, and he says, "When we lose the next war and an American boy lying in the mud with an enemy bayonet through his belly and an enemy foot on his dying throat spout out his last curse, I wanted the name not to be MacArthur but Roosevelt." That's what he said to Roosevelt about the reduction of the army. He goes, it won't be over something I did, and I'm fighting for this tooth and nail. You know, Roosevelt said, "You can't talk to a president like that." And MacArthur offered to resign. Roosevelt refused his request. It is said that MacArthur staggered out of the White House and threw up on the steps of the White House after that exchange. So he was a man who spoke his mind, and probably unwisely spoke his mind too many times. That's one time that was not a very discerning character. In one of his last speeches to his Rainbow Division, he said this: "The springs of human conflict cannot be eradicated through institutions, but only through the reform of the individual human being. We all dream of the day when human conduct will be governed by the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, and the Sermon on the Mount." Very interesting. A lot of his speeches are peppered with things like this. As I told you, he was brought up homeschooled with Bible lessons. He went through West Texas Military Academy, Chapel Daily, Bible lessons as one of their regular courses, and West Point was still allowing Bibles on their campus. I don't know if they still are, but they were at that time. I was looking through, I have a few Bibles on my shelf. One of the Bibles that I have is my dad's Annapolis Bible. So he went to the Naval Academy. So it was kind of fun to see that. I was like, well, at least in 1962 when he was there, they were still passing out Bibles at the Naval Academy. So it was just kind of fun to see. But after being our Army Chief of Staff, he was out of the Army at that point. He went and was the Field Marshal of the Philippine Army. So the Philippine President, Quezon, hired him to be the Field Marshal of their Army. So that's where he was at this particular time. So on his way there, he's on a ship going there in 35. There's another young lady on that ship as well. Her name was Jean, and Jean becomes his wife 2 years later. She was heading to Hong Kong, but decided not to go there, and they spent a lot of time in the Philippines together. Jean Faircloth was her name. They were married from 1937 to 1964 until his death, MacArthur's death. His first marriage, he was 42 years old. So just to give you a flavor, he waited a long, long time to do that. And on this trip to the Philippines, is his mother and sister-in-law, his brother's wife, who his brother had passed away, accompanied him on this trip. Arthur MacArthur was born in 1938 in the Philippines. He's Arthur MacArthur IV. That's a picture of them and the young Arthur MacArthur there coming off of a plane. And I didn't know this, but Arthur MacArthur and I share a birthday. Not the year, just the date. There's a little later picture of Arthur MacArthur graduating from college with mom and dad, Jean and Douglas there, but get a flavor. It was interesting. Douglas was named Father of the Year in 1942, and on doing that, this is just a quick quote from him. And I just was intrigued by the end. You know, he wants to remember him, and he repeating our simple daily prayer, "Our Father who out in heaven." He prayed with his son the Lord's Prayer. And a lot of people talk about what a devoted father he was. He loved children. When he was in the Philippines, he'd been in the Philippines a lot. So his dad was stationed there at a young age. So he was there then, he spent a lot of time in the Philippines. This is the third time he's been there, and so he understands Southeast Asia. He understands the culture there, and he loved the children there. He was often playing with the children in the Philippines, but he was named Father of the Year. He wrote a poem to his son. I don't have time to read it, but it was called A Father's Prayer, and build me a son, O Lord, who will be strong enough to know when he is weak, brave enough to face when he is afraid. One who will be proud and unbending and honest defeat and humble and gentle in victory. It goes on a few more stanzas, but he ends by saying, if I've done these things, my life will not have been in vain. So a very devoted father in terms of that, and trying to raise his son with biblical principles. That quote I put up at the very beginning by William Manchester. Manchester says, at one point, MacArthur read his Bible every day, but never attended church. He had to have attended church at some point because as I was reading a little bit about Arthur MacArthur, he's a bit of an enigma. He's actually still alive, and I think he's 80 or something. It was 1938, yeah, so he'd be 80. But he has withdrawn from public life. There's one article I saw back in the 60s or 70s or 80s. I can't remember what it was. But, where is Arthur MacArthur today? So there was still an intrigue with him. But especially when he was born, you got to remember, and some of you may remember, Douglas MacArthur was a larger-than-life figure. He was very popular. He was extremely charismatic. And so he drew crowds to him. He was... and so people were always watching from him. And people were wondering what his son was doing. And so Arthur got a lot of following. And one of the things I was reading about from a kind of a tabloid journalist, if you will, she was saying, the girls follow Arthur MacArthur everywhere. They wait for him at school. They wait for him on the steps of church when they are going in and coming out. So I just thought that. It was sort of a in passing comment, but I'm saying, well, okay, he could have never gone to church because obviously the girls were waiting for him, Arthur at church with his parents. So Douglas, I'm assuming, obviously attended church as well. So we can't take these, hyperbolic statements by certain people about him never attending church. But I take it by that is it wasn't his regular habit to attend church. But by taking it by saying he read his Bible every day, that probably isn't true either, but it was his regular habit to read his Bible regularly or daily, or trying to do that. Anyway, onward and upward. So there he is in the Philippines, okay, when World War II breaks out. And we're back on the outline there. It was while in the Philippines that MacArthur, he's now at the age of 61, was called back to active duty as commander of the Army's Far East Forces to prepare for its defense against the Japanese. The Japanese attacked the Philippines the day after Pearl Harbor, and an unprepared MacArthur was pinned and eventually ordered to leave in March of 1962 with a vow to return. This was really a bad move. I mean, it's surprising for a guy who was so such a military strategist, but he got stuck in Manila. They had a plan for when the Japanese were attacked, which include provisions and things like that, on the Bataan Peninsula there, you can see in red on the left. They just never moved a lot of the provisions over there. And so a lot of the provisions were stuck in Manila. His bombers and jets and fighters all got destroyed on the ground in Manila, so on the bases. So it was a bonehead move. I don't know what happened to him, but he just blew it. So, and then they're forced to the Bataan Peninsula there, and the most of his army is here. He's on Corregidor. You see that island down there? That's Corregidor. There's a base there, while most of his army's here. And they're getting pummeled by the Japanese as they're making their way down the Bataan Peninsula. There's one of the buildings in Corregidor, on Corregidor, of the bases. There's this Malinta Tunnel. So at some point with the Japanese bombing, everybody moved inside this tunnel, and you can see them up top here, just making their bay. There's MacArthur down here with one of his aides in the tunnel that's where they had to be, on Corregidor. Meanwhile, the army's getting bombed out on Bataan there. So, all right. One of the jokes was that MacArthur, they called him Dugout Doug, because he was up in this tunnel in Corregidor, and the troops gave him thought he was a coward. At least that's what they want to say. But there's the people on Corregidor would say every time the Japanese came out to bomb, he'd leave the tunnel and go out and watch it. So it's not like he was a coward. He was stuck. But this is one of the songs that was sung about MacArthur, and I only put this up here because of that second line. Now, this is sung to the Battle Hymn of the Republic. So, mine eyes have seen MacArthur with a Bible on his knee, and that's as far as I'm going to go. But I just thought that was interesting. They're making fun of him with a Bible on his knee. The reason I'm not going to sing the rest of it, because it gets a little weird at the bottom there, and I don't know how the tune... I know the tune, but it doesn't work, so I'm not going to sing it. But you can also see in the last line the arrogance that they thought he had about move over God, it's Mac. So, but they, the troops saw him with the Bible on his knee, so there's a definite reason, in terms of definite knowingness of him reading his Bible regularly, that they would make fun of that being a thing. But they called him Dugout Doug. Eventually, he was pulled out. He had to go by PT boat to break the Japanese blockade, and then he was flown out into Australia, and that's where they marshal their forces and start back. In the meantime, the Japanese took the troops, and both Filipino and American troops, and it's what's called the Bataan Death March. Again, Japanese were very brutal in this war, and the numbers are unclear, but they range from 60 to 80,000 men of U.S. and Filipino, mostly Filipino, that made this march. They estimate that 20,000 people died, men died, on this march from the Japanese brutality on the way up there. MacArthur knew about this and was sick for his men. And when he heard about it, this is what he wrote. He said, "To the weeping mothers of its dead, I can only say that the sacrifice and halo of Jesus of Nazareth has descended upon their sons, and that God will take them unto himself." You just don't hear people talking like that in the military, especially generals. So I continue to get the sense, you know, and a good strong feeling that, you know, he's guided by these principles, godly biblical principles, and giving comfort in terms of biblical principles, in terms of his men being at the side of Jesus as they've died. So, yeah, strong quote. There's a statue of MacArthur. It says, "I shall return," on the bottom, and that was a famous quote of his. The president didn't particularly care for that. He wanted him to say, "We shall return," but MacArthur said, "I shall return." But he took this personally, you know. He had a love for the Philippines. He took this personally, and he was mad. He's coming back. And so he said, "I shall return," and return he did. I think I said that back on there. But that's on Corregidor. But back on the outline here. And return he did in October of 1944 after 2 years of successful campaigning in the South Pacific. So they just moved their way from Australia. This is just kind of showing a little bit of what he did in New Guinea. Just island hopping, avoiding all of the Japanese strongholds, getting beachheads and establishing a defensive position in all these areas, driving the Japanese out, and that's what he did all the way to get back to the Philippines. And there he is. That's a famous picture. You probably have seen that, him landing in Leyte, him walking off. As I was watching a couple of interviews, some guy said there were multiple takes of this. Some others said, "No, that's just flat out untrue. He did it. He just did it." You know, and it's hard to know because there is a lot about MacArthur that is, I mean, very. He's very worried about his personal persona, and so he was one of the first to have his own publicist in the army, but years back from this. And the way he presented himself, he really cared about his public persona. And while he was Army Chief of Staff, I didn't mention this, but there was he was suing a couple of newspaper writers for defamation of character for about an article they wrote. And so, so they listed as one of their witnesses, the newspaper reporters for the court, a woman he was seeing. This is after his first marriage was gone, and in between, before his second marriage, a gal that he was dating. They called her his mistress, and they said they were going to bring her to the stand. Well, MacArthur didn't want that to happen, and so he settled out of court with these guys. So I'm assuming he didn't want his reputation tarnished in any way, shape, or form. There is a statue or a monument to his return to Leyte there, and that's what it looks like. This is what he said when he returned to the Philippines. "People of the Philippines, I have returned. By the grace of Almighty God, our forces stand again on Philippine soil." Again, invoking God in his speeches there. All right. So let's get back on the outline. So less than a year later, Japan surrendered. And as Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces, General MacArthur was in charge of helping rebuild Japan during this rebuilding. MacArthur, he showed his astute leadership and commitment to Christian principles. While many of the Allied nations were wanting to exact revenge on the Japanese, MacArthur was trying to rebuild a country in the image of the U.S. In its governmental structure, economy, and religion. The major political, social, and economic reforms instituted by MacArthur laid the groundwork for Japan to become one of the world's leading industrial powers. This is a very interesting time. As the Supreme Commander, this is a picture, obviously, of the surrender of the Japanese. A lot of people were calling for the emperor to be hung, tried and hung, but MacArthur recognized that without the emperor, he would have a difficult time getting the Japanese people to do what needed to be done to rebuild this nation. You know, a lot of people around the emperor were telling MacArthur that emperor wasn't involved. It was the warlords that were making all the decisions. That was a fiction, but a fiction that conveniently MacArthur chose to, you know, buy into in order to get done what he needed to get done. So you've got two bombs dropped. You've got mass destruction. You've got bombings of Tokyo. I mean, the place is a wreck, okay? People are starving. There are no, facilities, nothing. There's no water. Everything is in a chaos. One of the things MacArthur wanted to do, they had tons and tons of food and supplies for the U.S. Army still on Japanese soil. The U.S. people didn't want them to use it for help. MacArthur said, forget that. We're using it, again, bucking their orders to not use it, but he did. And just another picture of the Japanese contingent. Picture of MacArthur with the emperor. That's a famous one. You all have seen that, I'm sure. But he said this about his choice to Congress about giving that. He says, salvation breeds mass unrest, disorder, and violence. Give me bread or give me bullets. You know, basically, if you don't let me use the food, I'm going to have to fight another war here. And that's what could have happened. He did it. He used the U.S. food stockpiles to feed the Japanese there. The other thing he did was he called for missionaries and Bible societies to send Bibles and the missionary societies to send missionaries. A huge call went out for that. He was talking to the Catholic Church, Protestant churches, the Gideons, the American Bible Society, all of them. Millions of Bibles were sent to Japan. It was the bestseller in Japan for 2 years in a row when he called for that. But he recognized that Japan had been crushed, not just as a nation economically and socially, but spiritually, okay? The emperor was a god in that mind. Shinto was the religion, and those gods were defeated. And so you not only had a Japan that was, bereft economically and socially, but also spiritually. And MacArthur recognized that spiritual void needed to be filled, and he felt that could be best filled with Christianity. And so he made a call out for that. There's just one little article that was in there about MacArthur calling for Bibles as well. This is a telegram to the Gideons. I have publicly stated my firm belief that Christianity offers to Japanese a sure and stable foundation on which to build a democratic nation. Japanese are becoming increasingly aware of fundamental values of Christian religion and appreciative of its spiritual and moral blessing. He was adamant that this was what was needed in Japan. I mean, who calls for that, right? Who calls for, I mean, thinking in terms of that, the General MacArthur did. He calls for Christianity to fill the void and has Bibles shipped over. If this is a man that is devoid of any spiritual faith, I have a hard time seeing it when you do things like this. The missionaries did come. It was unfortunate, but most of them didn't speak Japanese, and it was very difficult for them to communicate and get through. And then with the social revolution of the 60s, unfortunately, Christianity took a turn for the worse there. But this is what he tried to do in the 40s after the war and in the rebuilding of Japan. So let's jump on to the Korean War that we meant to talk about, really, the whole time, right? But there's a lot that's going on with our friend Douglas here. All right. So back on the outline. So the tensions over the 5 years since the end of World War II continued to grow between the two Koreas. On June 25th, 1950, North Korea, with the backing of Communist China and Soviet Union, attacked across the 38th parallel. President Truman pushed for and received UN military support for a police action to repel the North Korean army. We never declared war on Korea. And so they're pushing back against communism ultimately. General MacArthur, he's now 70 years old, okay, was still overseeing the Japanese reconstruction, and his forces are immediately called to Korea. By September, the North Korean army had taken all but a small portion of the peninsula, and it was MacArthur's brilliant and decisive invasion at Incheon that cut off the North Korean supply and communication lines and began to drive their army back across the 38th parallel. So I found this intriguing little map. June 25th, you can see where we started here. By September, a couple of months, this is where North Korea had pushed them down to. This is Busan down here. That's what they had left of them. Okay, MacArthur comes in two months later, and attacks here, cutting off the supply lines and basically driving the enemy back to the 38th parallel and all the way up to the Yalu River, and that's back on the outline here. So the U.S. saw that this as an opportunity to eradicate communism from Korea, and by late November, it pushed North Korean forces all the way up to the Yalu River on the Chinese border. So they had moved them all the way up to Yalu here. See that up here? There's the Yalu River. That's the border with China. And then, unfortunately, late November 1950, over 400,000 Chinese soldiers poured into Korea and forced the UN troops back below the 38th parallel. So that's when the line was back established here. So here's where they drew them up to. Then this is where we ended up, you know. And that's basically from November of 1950 to the end of the war was pretty much stalemated at that 38th parallel. Kind of changed hands back and forth, but that's where it was. MacArthur advocated for bombing the Chinese mainland and blockading their coast. So he was wanting to be the aggressor with China, since they had, you know, poured into there and drove them back. President Truman rejected the strategy, not wanting to risk escalating this police action into World War III by inciting China and the USSR. MacArthur publicly criticized Truman, and he was promptly relieved of his command for his actions. A stalemate ensued until July 27, 1953, when an armistice was signed. So that's where he left it. This is a picture of MacArthur. When he left Korea, he came home. He came home to a ticker tape parade, okay? Very popular. Truman, not so popular. In fact, Truman knew he had one of the lowest popularity ratings during his presidency, and he actually decided not to run as a result of that. And then you've got an immensely popular guy in MacArthur. So here he is addressing Congress, that's where you get that line, old soldiers never die, they just fade away. That's the speech, his retirement speech to Congress, when he spoke that. There's a list of his medals. He obviously won the Medal of Honor. Well, I didn't tell you that, but he won the Medal of Honor in World War II. He and his dad were the first father and son to receive that. Do you know who the only other father and son to do that are? Teddy Roosevelt and his son. So, interesting. But it was after the he did. He received 3 Distinguished Service Crosses, 5 Army Distinguished Service Medals, 1 Navy Distinguished Service Medal, 7 Silver Stars, 4 Calling Birds, 3 French Hens, 1 Distinguished Flying Cross, 1 Bronze Star, 1 Air Medal, and 2 Purple Hearts. Interesting thing about the Purple Hearts, they didn't call them Purple Hearts at the time that he received them. They were back earlier. One of them was in World War I. But when he finally had the what we call the Purple Heart today, he had a number 1 etched on the back of it, that he was the first to receive it. So a little bit of that pride and, arrogance showing through. He was one of 5 of the 5-star generals. George Marshall was a 5-star general. Obviously, Douglas MacArthur. Dwight Eisenhower was a 5-star general. Omar Bradley, and then Henry Hap Arnold, another 5-star general. There's only 2 men that had higher ranks than a 5-star general, and that was Black Jack Pershing, John Pershing, and he was called the General of the Armies, looking at all the armies, and then. All of the military forces. And then you had George Washington, who is considered the general of generals and commander of chiefs. So one of the highest ranking guys there. The Crius Armistice was signed in 53, but we did not have a declaration for peace until April of this year, when the two leaders got together and decided that. So for all that time, the war had between the two Koreas had never been declared. It was an armistice. We're going to stop fighting, but no peace treaty. So this is going to pave the way for the peace treaty. Some people say this is the peace treaty, but it sounds like they just agree at this meeting to declare for peace. So MacArthur, as I said, he said some things he probably never should have. Eisenhower was his clerk, and he wasn't afraid to say it. Eisenhower was great because he fought back with this quote, "Oh yes, I studied dramatics under him for 12 years." They did like each other, but the things he said to Roosevelt, the things he said to a lot of people were not the nicest things in the world. In a speech in 1962 at West Point, we get his duty, honor, country, the 3 hallowed words reverently dictate what you ought to be, what you can be, and what you will be. That was a famous speech he did, but something that drove him for all of his life, duty, honor, and country. And I think we see that the man spent 60 years in the military. Again, this is part of his speech. He discloses those divine attributes which his maker gave when he created man in his own image. This is telling West Point cadets. So, all right, we must move on. He died on April 5th, 1964. There's just 2 sarcophagi of that. Lessons from the life of Douglas MacArthur. Pride. Not that we should learn to be prideful, but he definitely displayed a pride. Many believe MacArthur was a prideful and arrogant man. Certainly we see that in many of the things he said and did. But God obviously clearly hates this character. He opposes the proud, James 4:6. Submission. MacArthur was disrespectful a number of times in his career, also disobeyed orders. He would ignore them, ignore his superiors, and he'd do things without approval. Romans 13:1 tells us that we should be subject to our governing authorities. So something he didn't show. Some things he did show were discernment. He was a brilliant tactician. He was brilliant in the way he handled Japan and brought them, helped them do what they did in terms of knowing that culture, despite what Congress and the president were telling me should do in terms of how to deal with them. He showed incredible discernment regarding that. Integrity. Just the one act of, I'm going to return back to the Philippines, and some people argue maybe he took too much to that in terms of we shouldn't have been going back to the Philippines as soon as he wanted to, but he said he was going to do it, and he did it. He went back. Sorry, I'm moving fast because I realize I am way out of time. Giftedness. I put this down because of the fact that he did spend so much time in the military. You think about, I mean, he was at odds with a lot of people. He could have just retired early on, and he could have been done with it. But I think at some level, I mean, maybe this is where the pride comes in, is he recognized that he was good at what he did, and he felt like he could do a good job. And a lot of the things he said about communism and the things he told presidents, even President Kennedy, you know, they came true, even though they weren't true at the time. But he was very discerning, and he had a gift for understanding politics and world politics and how people thought, and he definitely showed that. So we should continue with our giftedness no matter what. All right, that was a lot, and we are well over time. Next week we have navigating famous museums, the British Museum. But for now, let me pray for us. Father God, we just thank you so much that we are able to learn from the life of Douglas MacArthur. What a great man. What a man that we see embodied some biblical principles in his life. He was not afraid to speak those things, and the things that we saw, I think we can say that he was guided by your hand and guided by he was guided by your principles. So it's great to see that in such a prolific figure, a larger than life figure, one that was popular but also was willing to speak the principles of your word in his speeches, in his men, in his letters, and in the way he went about his business, not only on the battlefield, but also just in civilian life and in his various appointments. God, may we be as bold as Douglas MacArthur in how we exhibit our faith in our spheres of influence, in our work, in our family, in our neighborhoods, Lord. And let him be an example to us in that. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.